All right, well, good morning, friends. Good morning. Good to be here today. If we haven't met yet, my name is Dan. I have the privilege of serving as the teaching pastor for the Worthington campus. And before we get started, let me just say, this is not part of our normal rhythm. Like, we don't really do video teaching. A lot of you know, though, that in addition to my role at LifePoint as one of the teaching pastors, I also have the opportunity to serve as a chaplain with the Air Force. So as of right now, that's I'm away on some Air Force time, and I will be spending the next several weeks at Vance Air Force Base in Enid, Oklahoma. So that's where I'm at. We will not be doing video messages really at any other point in the year. Just felt like this was a message that needed to be coming from me, who knows you as our church family. So that's why we're doing this today. We are continuing in our series through the Old Testament book of Song of Songs. So if you have a Bible, why don't you meet me there? Song of Songs, chapter 4 and 5. We're going to be reading through that whole section and kind of sticking at the end of chapter 4 today. Now, if you've been with us over the last couple of weeks, you know that Song of Songs is a challenging book of the Bible. And a lot of that has to do with the genre. Like, it's poetry. Most of us don't spend a whole lot of time reading poetry at all. And this is ancient poetry, like 3,000 years old. We have a hard enough time with Shakespeare, and he kind of wrote in English, okay? This is 3,000 years removed, using images, language that really just don't exist in a meaningful way anymore today. Poetry, by its very nature, is hard. Like, it forces us to slow down, to think, to imagine, to contemplate. And good poetry is always trying to move us from these concrete ideas to things that are far more abstract, right? And that forces us to slow down, to really track with what the poem is trying to get across to us. But I suspect the real reason that Song of Songs is so challenging is not because of the genre. It's actually because of the subject. A Song of Songs is a poem that meanders its way through the complexities of human love, desire, and longing. It vividly explores and celebrates the sexual relationship between a husband and wife. We spent some more time talking about that last week. In fact, Song of Songs uses such striking language and imagery that for a long time there was a debate about what to even do with this book. Like, does it even belong in the Bible with the collection of the other sacred writings? We went into way more detail about this back in week one. If you missed that, you can go and listen to that message. But the debate was eventually settled when people began to realize that through all of this imagery, as vivid as it is, Song of Songs is doing what all great poetry does. It's trying to move us from the concrete to the abstract, to moving us from this concrete image of the relationship between a man and woman, a husband and wife, and using that to point to something far more transcendent and far more abstract, pointing us to the powerful and mysterious love that God has for his people. Think about it this way. We've been using this analogy all along in the series. Imagine for a moment that an architect has designed a brand new city center, complete with towers, parks, shops, public transit, all of it. If that architect has any hope of getting people to see what she sees, to buy into the vision that she has for this city center, she doesn't just start handing out a bunch of schematics and spreadsheets that run through equations and tonnage to show what this city's going to be like. No, nobody would be able to wrap their mind around that. What she does instead is build a small-scale model of the real thing. It's called an architect's model, right? And she'll set it right down the table for everyone to come up and look at, to start to grasp the intricacy of this massive project, to see it from unique vantage points that you would not otherwise be able to see. Here's the thing. The model, the scale model, it's real. Like, you can go up, you can touch it, you can study it, you can learn about it, you can wrap your arms around it and get an idea for how this thing is supposed to work. But as real as that model is, it does not exist just to be looked at. As beautiful and as intricate as it may be, the model exists, really exists, to point to the full-scale project. Friends, this is what Song of Songs is saying, that God has created an architect's model and set it right down in the middle of the human experience, the marriage and intimacy between a husband and wife. But that model, it does not exist for itself. It is pointing to something more, something far bigger, something far more real. And listen, I know I keep talking about this every week. You're probably bored of that analogy by now. Dan, get some new material. I get it. But I think this image is vital for us to hold on to, especially in this week. You're going to see why as we keep moving through. A lot of ways you can think of this message as part two of a conversation we started about 2 weeks ago in week three of this series, a conversation about sexual intimacy. And in that first message, week three, we talked about that many of us have been handed a script for sex, often defined by fear and silence or rules that felt like a commodity-based transaction. Even the language we use to talk about sex often in the church emphasizes that it's kind of a commodity and kind of a transaction. We explored how these strategies, even if intended for protection, often produced shame. If you missed that week, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to it. It was a challenging conversation for us to navigate through. But today, we're moving from deconstructing some of those old scripts to reconstructing a vision for intimacy that is good, healthy, and holy. So if you're not there yet, open with me to Song of Songs, chapter 4. Song of Songs, chapter 4. Let's get started with this, looking at the architect's model, the thing that God has placed right down in the center of the human experience, this husband and wife. We'll look at this starting at verse 7, chapter 4, verse 7. This is the husband talking, the man talking. And it's a bit of a longer poem or longer section, but I want you to get a feel for the imagery and all of what is being talked about here in chapter 4. He says this to her, "You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amanah, from the peak of Sinar, from Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You've captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister and my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips drip nectar. My bride, honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride, a spring locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with all the choicest fruit, henna with nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all the choice spices, a garden fountain, a well of living water and flowing streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind. Blow upon my garden. Let its spices flow." The woman responds with this, "Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits." He says, "I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh, my spice, I ate my honeycomb with my honey, I drank my wine with my milk, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love." So, there's a lot there, right? There's a lot going on there. This is ancient poetry, but the imagery is very vivid. And if at any point you're like, is that saying what I think it's saying? Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. The Bible is not blushing here, and neither should we. Right, we are talking about, in chapter 4, we are talking about the physical sexual relationship between husband and wife. And no, I did not plan to be out of town for this message so that I can just avoid being in the room, okay? What I want you to see is that Song of Songs is saying something really important about this architect's model that God has set right in the middle of the human experience, this husband and wife relationship. He's talking about the desire that they have. It's saying that that desire, that sexual relationship is good and right. Right? That it's something to be enjoyed. That God has created this kind of intimacy for pleasure and enjoyment. Look at verse 16 again. Right? This is the call and response between the two of them. He says, "Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, let its spices flow." And she responds, "Let my beloved come into his garden and eat its choicest fruits." I mean, they're talking about their bodies and this mutual enjoyment of each other. She says it this way earlier on in chapter 2, "My beloved is mine and I am his." Right? They belong to each other. They have given themselves to one another. They delight in one another. They are secure in one another. They are vulnerable and safe with one another. Listen, I think we need to pause here just to be super clear about what we're talking about. Because Song of Songs isn't just talking about sex. It is and it isn't. The way we tend to use that word today, I mean, it has a heavy emphasis on what you could boil down to like a biological impulse. And sure, that is part of it, but we just talk about this as being human, like a human need to have sex. But that's not really what this poem is describing, is it? I think we lose something of the mystery and beauty and power if we boil this down to mere biology, if we just talk about sexual intercourse. No, I think we need a different vocabulary to talk about what Song of Songs is really describing. And it sounds so subtle and simple, but I want you to hang with me for a minute as we explore this. The phrase I want to use, and I'd encourage you to kind of bring into your own vocabulary, especially if you're married, to bring this into how you talk about this topic with your spouse. I want us to talk about good sex. Good sex. This is what Song of Songs is describing. Good sex. And I think both of these words are phenomenally important here. Let me explain. Something interesting happens as you read through Song of Songs. Again, I've encouraged you a couple times to sit down and read through the whole thing in one sitting. And one of the things you'll notice is that I think the most popular image that the author draws from is the image of a garden. In fact, 10 times Song of Songs will talk about the garden. They'll talk about the husband and wife. They'll talk about their bodies as a garden or sneaking away off into the garden. And in this short book, we find the man and woman talking about the garden as this place of sexual connection. It's where they come together to be together. In fact, there is no other book of the Bible that talks more about, you know, this garden language than the Song of Songs. None, that is, other than the very first book of the Bible, Genesis, in the Garden of Eden. You may have already been picking up on this through the first couple weeks. You see, part of what makes this great poetry, not just pretty good poetry, but great poetry, is the number of allusions in this poem that pull us out of just the story and Song of Songs and into the much larger story of the Bible. This is why the earliest readers of this book said, absolutely, there is something sacred here, right? And when we think back to the garden, like Eden, in Genesis chapters 1-3, we find, like, interestingly, a really similar story unfolding there between another man and woman, Adam and Eve, who come together, and there is love there in this this vulnerable type of love in their relationship. And this Garden of Eden is defined by a very specific Hebrew word. The word is tov. Everything God creates in Genesis 1 is called tov. Humanity is called tov ma'od, which means in Hebrew, exceedingly good. Tov means the way it should be, or how it was designed. Tov means what God intended. Simply put, tov means good. It means good in the broadest sense imaginable. Stay in Genesis for just a moment longer, and we see the first description of what we could call good sex. Genesis 4, verse 1 says this: Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, a son. Look at that word, knew. Got it underlined on the slide. In the original language that this is written in, again, Hebrew, it's the word yada. Right, and I find it so interesting that the very first description of sex in the Bible isn't just a gloss over a physical act because it's, you know, too embarrassed to talk about what's actually going on. No, it's actually this wonderfully rich metaphor. Adam knew his wife. Right, and we tend to think of knowing as this intellectual head knowledge kind of thing, but yada is different. That's not what's being communicated there. Yada is the kind of knowledge that only comes from a deep relational experience. It means to be intricately acquainted with someone's inner world, to know that, to truly see them, their vulnerabilities, their story, to see their truest self. It means to be fully seen and accepted. That is what it means to be known. In her book, which I found fascinating, The Great Sex Rescue, sociologist Sheila Gregory says it this way. She says, sex is the fulfillment of a longing for intimacy, for connection, to be completed and utterly bare in every way before each other. Yes, bearing ourselves physically is necessary for sex, but that's not the only kind of bearing that real sex involves. It's also a bearing of our souls, a deep hunger for connection, a longing. When we talk about good sex, tov sex, we aren't talking about performance and techniques. We're talking about alignment. Think of it this way. If you have a beautifully crafted tool, like a finely tuned chisel, right? It is good when it is used to create according to the maker's intent. If you try to use that same chisel to hammer a nail into concrete, it's not that the chisel is bad or that there's something wrong with the chisel, right? But it's being used in a way contrary to its purpose. It no longer is able to fulfill the tov, the goodness that it was built for. Good sex, you see, is aligned with the architect's original model, the original purpose for it. It's functioning in the way that it was designed to function, to create connection, to cultivate vulnerability, to reflect the goodness that God has towards us. And so, Song of Songs can say, this husband can say to his wife, they can say to each other, my beloved is mine, and I am his. They have given themselves to one another. It can say, awake, O north wind, O come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, let its spices flow. She says, let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. Okay. Now, here's the obvious problem with everything I just talked about. everything I just said about good sex is best case scenario. First of all, you might not even be married right now, and you're going to think about it this way. We're going to talk about what this means for someone who's not married. I want you to hang in with me for a little bit longer. And for those of you who are married, it is certainly possible that you are thinking, Dan, you absolutely nailed it. That is exactly what we experience in our marriage all the time. But, you know, being ever the pessimist, I've got a sneaking suspicion that that's not what most of us are thinking. Before we talk about anything else, let me just say, if that's you, like if you're sitting here, maybe next to your spouse, maybe not, and actually getting more and more discouraged by the moment, let me say, you are not alone. Not a single person in this room has a perfect marriage, not even close. Courtney and I do not have a perfect marriage. We do not practice this perfectly. I am 100% not talking about this from the perspective who's figured it all out and finally has a silver bullet to offer to you. No. Friends, we are in this together. That's part of what it means to be engaged in a church community, that we are joined to people who are all works in progress. That said, I think it might be helpful to think about good sex this way, bit of a framework. Good sex isn't a state you achieve. It's not a magical state you just somehow arrive in one day. No, good sex is a garden you cultivate. It's a garden you cultivate. It's daily intentional work. And so, for the rest of our time, I want us to talk about, briefly, how we actually begin to tend the garden. And listen, I'm not going to hand you a list of techniques for a better sex life. If you're looking for a quick fix to ignite intimacy, I think you're really looking for a shortcut that doesn't exist. And if it does, it can be really temperamental and oftentimes more dangerous than we recognize. In a garden, the only things that grow fast are weeds. I think good sex is cultivated. It is grown through slow, daily, intentional activity. Right? And if we want to cultivate this, we have to start with our posture, not our practices. We so often want to flip these things around. Practices are not going to produce the posture in this case. And so the first thing I would say to you, if you're a married couple here today or thinking about marriage in the future, take the posture of a gardener. Take the posture of a gardener. Take the posture of someone who is committed to the long game, the slow work of tending, pruning, weeding, and feeding. Ask yourself this. In fact, in the notes, if you're following along today, we have a whole list of questions that you can take and talk with your spouse through these questions. It's 10 questions that will be phenomenally important as you start to take the posture of a gardener in your marriage together. But here's one of those questions. What is my posture towards my spouse right now? What's my posture? Am I more invested in my needs, my desires, my wants, or theirs? And by the way, these questions, they will only be helpful if you're willing to be honest. The other thing I'd say is this, and it's going to sound strange at first because I don't think we're used to hearing this passage in this context, but I think this is absolutely a part of what the Apostle Paul was talking about when he lays out the posture for followers of Jesus as we relate to one another. Philippians 2 says it this way, "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourself. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others." And again, we don't typically think of this passage when it comes to our sex lives, but Paul absolutely envisions that we would apply this same posture to our spouse. Like, at the very least, we'd be applying it there. As a gardener, cultivating good sex in your marriage, you are not just looking out for new things that you can try to incorporate. You are looking to take a selfless posture before your spouse, to know them, to yada them, to know what they need, to care about what they care about. Here's another question. You can find it on that same document too. Am I a learner of my spouse? Am I a learner of my spouse? Do I genuinely want to know them and be fully known by them? Good sex, tov sex, is simply the overflow of a selfless, covenantal, I am my beloved's and he is mine kind of love. The practices, love notes, date nights, whatever you want to add to that, and they are just tools that we can use to help us stay in the posture of humility. They won't change your marriage if your heart is still fixed on yourself. Here's the second thing. As a gardener, you must be mindful of the season. Listen, I get it. Some of you might be thinking right now, like, Dan, you've been married for 14, 15 years or so. Talk to me again when it's 40 years in. That's a fair critique. Like, I'm not there. But what I would say is that marriage goes through seasons. All marriages go through seasons. And good sex is not just possible in all of them. I think it's meant to grow richer in all of them. It just looks different. A garden in the frantic blooming energy of spring operates differently than an established garden in the deep, quiet maturity of an autumn harvest. Like, you can't demand the same expression of intimacy at year 40 than you had that you had in year one. But hear me on this. That does not mean year 40 is like a barren winter. Year 40 has the potential to yield a depth of connection and profound safety and vulnerability that year one could only dream of. The roots can go so much deeper, the fruit so much sweeter. Right? The goal isn't constantly try and recreate year one. Some of you are like, thank the Lord, I never want to go back to year one. Right? But the goal is to ask, how are you continuing to know your spouse in the season you're in now? And whether it's in the sheer exhaustion of raising toddlers, the transition to an empty nest, shifting health, or the physical realities of aging, how has your spouse changed? Do you know the season you're in? How have you changed? Because good sex is so intricately caught up in being genuinely known and knowing one another, we have to give time and space for honest conversation in whatever season we find ourselves. I'll never forget some of the advice Courtney and I got when we were first married, and one couple sat us down and they said, look, in the next couple of months, like year one, if you get a marriage book, you're gonna flip right to the sex chapter. And then you're going to find out as you get to year two through whatever long that, like, that's not really the chapter you need. You need the communication chapter. How do you talk to each other? How do you have honest, real, and vulnerable conversation? It does not happen by accident. Ask yourself this. When is the last time we had a truly honest conversation about our sex life? Truly honest conversation. Listen, I know that is not an easy conversation to have. It's generally why we tend to avoid it. Like, for some of you, even the thought of doing that feels like walking into a minefield. You know that conversation brings up tense, painful, or difficult things you'd rather not talk about. Maybe that's why it's walled off from what you guys chat through. But here is the truth. The garden. See, you and I, we have to face the weeds if we want to see the fruit. We cannot cultivate a healthy garden if we're not willing to talk through the weeds. Have the conversation, not to blame, but to learn. I'm going to challenge you this week. Look at those list of questions in the Notes app. Set them aside. Save them on your phone. Block off an hour to work through a couple of them. Probably not all 10 at once. But lean in to the hard conversation. I even have some guidelines at the very top of that that kind of set the tone and a set of commitments that the two of you will make before you have the conversation, because it can be so challenging. Finally, I'd say this. You do not have to tend the garden alone. Right? I know for some of you, listening to a message about good sex, again, doesn't feel inspiring. It feels exhausting. Feels exhausting. Maybe even painful. You might be sitting there thinking right now, like, Dan, you don't get it. I am trying. I'm trying to have these conversations. I'm trying to lean in. I'm showing up. I want to be there. But the soil is so hard. And maybe you are facing real complex barriers, whether there's medical realities, physical pain, changing hormones, changing bodies, emotional exhaustion, or just the very heavy and real weight of past trauma. Right now, the garden may feel overgrown, or maybe it feels impossible to even venture into. Let me just say, as your pastor for a moment, if I could. That is real. And God sees you in that. No matter what side of the relationship you are on, desperately afraid to enter the garden, or feeling like you keep trying to walk in there alone, God sees you. And we live in a broken world, which means our bodies and our stories carry brokenness, sometimes in ways we don't even recognize yet. Maybe the weeds are just too thick to clear by yourself. See, hitting a wall is not a sign that you are a failure as a spouse or a couple. It might just mean you need an arborist. You got a beautiful, mature tree in your yard and it's struggling. Like, the first step isn't just to chop it down. You call an expert in who can help you treat the roots. Seeking out counsel from another seasoned, respected couple in your life, or marriage counselor, a doctor, is not a confession of defeat. It's a profoundly courageous act. You can reach out to myself. You can reach out to Jason. And we'd be more than happy to chat with you and connect you with a counselor that we know. I mean, it is a sign of a gardener who loves their spouse, who loves the covenant enough to say, we need outside help to flourish again. Friends, hear me. There is absolutely zero shame in seeking the resources you need to pursue good sex, to pursue what is tov. Finally, we'll close with this. If good sex is the architect's model, what is it actually saying to us about the full-scale reality? If the model's pointing to something, what is it pointing toward? Recently discovered a fascinating story about a medieval theologian named Thomas Aquinas. And if you're not familiar with him, he is arguably the greatest intellectual mind the Christian tradition has ever produced. I mean, it may not even be close. The man who wrote literally millions of words of dense, brilliant theology to try and get his arms around the deep mysteries of God. At the very end of his life, Aquinas talked about this mystical encounter that he had with God in prayer, where he felt like God gave him a vision to see something spectacular. And his response to that vision, with like the one who had been writing his entire life, said, I'm done. I will never write again. All that I have written is like straw in the wind compared to what I have seen. Do you know what he asked for in his final days? This great intellectual, the one who had, dove through the depths of the mysteries of who God is. He asked to be read over and over again, the Song of Songs. He knew that after all his study, the ultimate reality wasn't a brilliant idea or just a robust theological system, both of which he created. The most important, most compelling truth to him was the intimate yada, the deep soul level knowing of God. He understood that the human intimacy, the good sex that's being talked about in this poem, as beautiful as it is only a scale model. It's meant to be a breathtaking, evocative pointer to the real thing. Listen, the vital truth, sex itself was never meant to satisfy you. It never will, because it was never designed to do that. It was designed to point you to something far more real, far more enduring, far more intimate. And this is the good news for every single one of you. Regardless of your relationship status, if you're married, your intimacy is a tool designed to point you to and your spouse to the eternal, faithful affection of God, who has a passionate desire for you. It's meant to be a practice ground for the kind of self-giving, selfless, and vulnerable love that Jesus has for his church. But if you're single, widowed, or divorced, I want you to hear this. You are not left out of this intimacy. The ache, the longing for connection, the deep nagging desire to be fully known and fully accepted is not a mistake. That is a holy hunger. It's your soul correctly identifying that you were built for intimacy, but not with intimacy just with another human being. No, you and I were built, no matter how wonderful that human connection can be, we were built for something that can actually satisfy. That hunger you have is an echo of your soul's deepest, maybe unvoiced longings for God. See, ultimately, the story of the gospel, the story of Jesus, is the story of God coming to know us, to yada us, to see us completely and fully, see all of our failures and flaws, and to still love us in our, nakedness, and like the couple in the garden, to cover us with his grace. Now, he did not wait for us to get cleaned up. He came into our brokenness. He came into our sin and our shame. And the story of Jesus shows us how he paid the price for our rejection of him so that we could have a permanent seat at his table in his presence so that we could be welcomed in. And so before you look at your spouse or anyone else to be your ultimate satisfaction, look to the one who has designed the garden in the first place, who called it good and invites you to enter in. Stop hunting for validation that only God can give. When you find your identity in the one who knows you fully and loves you perfectly, you are finally free. Pursue what is toes. Free from the pressure. Free from the need to use others to fill your emptiness. Free to actually love and know others as a gift rather than an idol. The architect's model, you see, is a beautiful place to live. But don't forget, it is not the final building. Let your longings, your desires, your desires for intimacy in whatever season of life you're in point you to the source who can satisfy all of it. If you're here today and you've never fully experienced that full-scale reality, if you've never put your faith in the one who has chased after you, who has gone all the way to the cross for you, I want to invite you to him today to put your faith in Jesus, to find the source of living water. Come to him who knows you fully and loves you perfectly. Let him fill your deficit. Come and drink from the living water. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this time. We ask that you would speak to us long after we leave this place. If there's a set of conversations maybe we need to have with our spouse, God, would you continue to come back to this? Allow us to enter into that time with intentionality. Lord, where we may need to speak truth in love or just celebrate and thank you for the good gifts that you have given us. Father, for others of us who are in a spot where we feel like there's just not hope, that the garden is, it's got too many issues. We pray, Lord, that ultimately you would begin the work of restoration, of bringing health. Help us to take the posture of gardeners, committed to the slow but faithful work of pruning, weeding, and feeding. And if we're here today, not in a relationship like marriage, Father, would you remind us that that ache we feel for connection, it's real and it's not, there's nothing wrong with it. It's actually a holy hunger that you have given us to direct again our hearts, our minds, our attention, and our affection back to the only one who could possibly satisfy. So we trust you, we thank you, and pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.